The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Ashley Frawley is a frequent guest on Sky News and the BBC. She is the author of The Semiotics of Happiness, and she's on the editorial team at Zero Books. This week, she's also the guest on the podcast as we discuss the need for a recommitment to a critical humanism, the question of human subjectivity, and the UK smacking ban. It's Wednesday, February 6th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in its entirety to our Patreon supporters, which means that if you're listening to one of our three free feeds, you'll be hearing an excerpt from the interview. Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. If you're listening for free, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcast each week. I hope you enjoy them. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit remix of Daft Punk's Human After All. And in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ashley Frawley and I discuss the need for a new humanism.
It seems really esoteric, but it actually really matters how you conceive of human beings and the capacity of human beings and human nature. If you're ever going to have any conceptualization of freedom, then you need to think about the subject. So I think right now we're having a lot of trouble with the concept of freedom because we have such a weak conceptualization of subjectivity. So if you think of human beings as, by definition, by their very nature, very weak, irrational, quite easily led astray, needing to be protected, then freedom isn't an aspiration. It's a problem. It's something that needs to be rooted out.
I've been reading and listening to lectures by Francis Fukuyama lately because I feel as though we're all Fukuyamas, even though we pretend not to be.
You know, there is a great irony at work in the fact that maybe Fukuyama has won.
Basically believe that the capitalist system is the only system possible. I find myself quite liking Francis Fukuyama. Like I listen to him and watch his manner, and he seems sincere and likable. But he's a Hegelian, and he has a very interesting kind of approach to understanding liberalism and understanding politics. I think because he's a Hegelian, he essentially views the state as the ultimate subject. The creation of a liberal democratic state is the goal of his politics. And because of that, he's not as concerned about individual liberty as you might think. Like, he doesn't actually prioritize democracy. The thing he prioritizes is the power of the state. That has to come first. And he, you know, historically it does. So if we conceive of humanism, or if we conceive of the human subject in terms of its collective, in terms of collective organization, in other words, we are historical beings that change based on how we distribute power and how we organize ourselves collectively, then the defense of, say, anti-speech laws or a number of authoritarian kind of moves is easier to make. This is something I'm struggling with because I don't think it's entirely wrong to say that what is a human being is determined by the kind of political and social order that they're within, and that part of the goal of human liberation would be to construct a more equitable, more democratic, and more responsive state power or social power.
Yeah, you have to be careful, though. I mean, you don't, when you say determined, that's, you know, that's where you go astray, not you go astray, but where it, the argument can easily go astray, because yes, human beings are, you know, conditioned by the world in which we find ourselves. But we're not determined, wholly determined. Otherwise, you'd have a whole, you have a lot of trouble explaining social change. You know, the possibility of change, it doesn't exist. And of course, you know, everybody knows Marx's famous phrase in the 18th Brumaire, where he says, man makes the world, but not in conditions of his own choosing. It's not exactly the quote, but it's a, you know, it's a two-way thing. We all have power to change the world and to change our circumstances, that every human being is part of something that already exists, but also changes it in a small way.
Right. But the question is, go ahead.
The problem is that you can wind up saying that, well, you know, in order to change the world, you need to use the state to change things. And that there's the only possibility of social change is through sort of institutional social engineering. So you go into schools and like teach kids before they're, you know, because once you get to adults, you're too far gone. So if you have a totally deterministic view of human beings, there's no point in democracy. There's no point in trying to convince people. We just need really strong state mechanisms to change people's minds without their realizing it and to go into schools and change people before they have a chance to grow up and get and become the horrible monsters that they are. And like, well, this just flies in the face of reality. I mean, like en masse, human beings in a particular historical epoch might be more or less predictable, but they're not wholly predictable. You can't decide what every single human being is going to say or how they're going to act. And you can't say in advance what every single child is going to become or believe or think on the basis of their upbringing. So even this ideology that seems unspoken, that seems to drive a lot of the conceptualization of historical change now, which is driven by determinism, that we are wholly determined, it doesn't even match just everyday experience or understanding of what it's like to be in the world.
Right. Okay. So let's say that we're not wholly determined, but that we're limited. So there are certain kinds of things that won't occur in a given historical moment. Like, for instance, human flight. That, you know, like it, before the 20th century, people weren't going to be flying. And they may want to, they may have all sorts of conceptions about it, but they didn't have the capacity to until things historically developed and to the point where they technologically could. So some similar things might be true on the level of culture, that certain cultural conceptions simply can't arise until there's changes historical changes in the material basis, say, of reality or in the state. We can see then that while there's maybe quite a bit of room within a culture for a diversity of views, there are some hard limits in any given historical moment. And that means that individuals aren't setting the terms of their own limitations.
I think probably there's, I don't know if this is going too far off topic, but there's always, you know, technology always runs a little bit ahead of, in fact, the best technology runs ahead of our ability to make sense of it socially and politically. But once we have that these possibilities somewhere on the horizon, the way that we think about the world changes, and we try our best to move toward those things. I think as human beings, we when some sort of emancipatory technology becomes available and we can start to see its abilities, we start to move toward it. And that's the part of the engine of human change, what changes us. I don't know. There's always these things going on. There's never any sort of like steadfast limit at any given time. You know, there's always the precursors of something bubbling up, that some kind of possibility. And it could all go to, you know, it could all go to hell. It could all be destroyed. But I think in every epoch, there's always something that some potentially world changing thing that's happening. Even like flight, you know, people were imagining it.
Sure. Yeah. And they were not just imagining it, but they were working on it. It was a social goal, and it, you know, it's one that we managed to achieve. So, and you can start to predict and have some confidence in predicting what sorts of ambitions are going to be successful in a given historical moment. You know, you could have guessed at the turn of the 20th century that we would have had some sort of human flight within the next 30 years, that there was, I mean, there, many people didn't, but it might have been possible to see, at least, you know, to make a good guess. But that's all sort of to the side of the real question, which is, to what degree is collective organization central to any vision of what it is to be human? And then if it is central, how do we negotiate the individual's rights within a context of a collective subject? When Fukuyama says that he doesn't think that, like he recently spoke about free speech in the context of fake news and digital media and social media. And his position was that basically the United States, and its kind of hard commitment to the First Amendment and its anything goes kind of attitude towards speech, was an example of American exceptionalism, which he wanted to question. He thought that it was not that dissimilar to the way that the United States doesn't provide for its citizens in terms of universal health care or welfare support, and that it's been shown in Europe that there are ways for the state to very adequately set standards around speech, just as the state can provide universal health care, and that the American approach to speech issues was not necessarily the best or most liberal or the most sound approach. What's being contested is how we organize collectively, how we come together to create a human subject through institutions, and what kinds of limits we want to maybe even aim at.
The collective subject isn't like, there's a contradiction in the collectivity of the subject, that the more we come together as human beings, the more free we are as individuals. So it's that collectivity that gives us freedom. But of course, I mean that on the production side. So, you know, we come together and we create things. And because I don't know who it is that made my dinner today, like, you know, I mean, well, my husband made dinner, but, you know, who it is that ultimately, you know, butchered the cow or whatever. I don't have to think about all of that stuff. And that gives me the freedom, therefore, to talk to you and to think about these sorts of things. So it's that collectivity, ironically, that incredible embeddedness in society that I don't even know. I don't even realize that there are all these human beings that are involved in bringing these things together. That's what ultimately gives me freedom. So collectivity doesn't necessarily mean like, well, because you have, therefore you have a responsibility to other people, that you must therefore limit that freedom because, I don't know, you should feel bad that somebody had to butcher your cow or something. I think that the more individual that we become, the freer we become, the more time that we have to think about things and to create for ourselves. This is, I think, the goal of human activity. And to say that we ought to subordinate that, I think that the burden of, I don't know what the right word is for this, but you know, you'd have to, the threshold ought to be, I don't, to give that up, it's too much. I think what's the point of doing anything if it's not to increase our freedom and control of our lives? That's what I think the whole communist project is about, is to allow us to have the kind of freedom that only a few people get.
I agree with you, of course, and I'm playing devil's advocate here in this conversation, but I'm just trying to, really, I'm cheating. I'm trying to have you buttress whatever arguments I have to present tomorrow to Varn. But what I'd say to that is that, you know, the value of liberty and freedom, that is not the only value that you'll find in human societies. Not that it isn't I tend to think that in individuals, it is a fundamental value, that it is the combination of our ability to reason and reflect and our desire for free expression and free creation are what defines us as human. That's where I would stake my claim to being a kind of humanist, is my commitment to those values. But, you know, there's the Chinese model, which doesn't particularly privilege individual liberty, but privileges loyalty to authority and conformity in a more authoritarian system. And I'm not saying, I mean, that sounds maybe like I'm bashing the Chinese, and I don't think that that's like the character of a Chinese person particularly, but there are Chinese officials who will argue that, you know, the Chinese model, the Chinese culture simply doesn't have the same sets of values as Western cultures, and that they operate just fine without them. This notion of individual liberty is a contested idea.
Yeah, of course it's a contested idea. I think that's the issue that we have at the moment. I just finished reading, any sociologist is supposed to read C. Wright Mill's Sociological Imagination. And I think most people just read the first chapter. I had only read the first chapter. And I just finished reading it very closely. And at the end of the book, he talks about how the whole goal of the social sciences is to further human reason and freedom. And everybody always talks about the promise of sociology and the social sciences, which is to, link individual problems to broader structural forces, the link between biography and history, as he calls it. And everybody always remembers that bit. But nobody remembers the part about freedom and reason. And I found that very interesting, that that's just been like jettisoned from the whole narrative of C. Wright Mills. And I think, yeah, that these values are definitely thrown into question. That's part of the reason, part of the issue that we have at the moment, is that there are no values on which we can all agree. But the thing is that I guess you kind of have to make a stand for some values, and that it allows us to live better together, that is a better way to live.